Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Texas Department of Human Services versus Hines from El Paso County. City of Beaumont and Others versus Bouillon and Others from Jefferson County. And Holloway versus Skinner and Alvin Ords, Inc. from Travis County. In the first and third causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. In the second cause, 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of their time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude these arguments before the lunch break. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of these arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Department of Human Services versus Hines.
May it please the court, Mr. Horn will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. We believe that trial court erred when it refused to submit our proffered jury instruction with respect to the causal link between Mr. Hines' whistleblowing conduct and the conduct of the agency. We believe that in the absence of an appropriate instruction on the causative relationship between an employer's protected conduct and an employer's motive, for their conduct, a jury cannot be expected to render a verdict to permit the proper resolution of this or other whistleblower cases. And as a result, the public policy considerations which favor protection of whistleblowers are not served, and the doctrine of employment at will is seriously eroded. When, as here, the liability attaches as a result of the improper motivation of an employer, the ultimate question becomes, how do we go about determining what the motivation of the employer is? The employment at will doctrine has been in place and well-founded in the state of Texas for over 106 years. Exceptions to the employment at will doctrine are rare and done only in cases where public policy considerations demand that. The best example that I can think of is in the Sabine Pilot case, which prohibits termination of an employee who refuses to perform an illegal act. This court carved out what it called a very narrow exception and required of the plaintiff that he prove that the reason for his discharge, that his refusal to perform the illegal act was the sole reason for his discharge, and that no other reason had anything to do with his discharge. The concurring opinion in that case applauds that exception and urges further exceptions. And more recently, this court in the Ingersoll Rand case carved out a narrow exception in which the causative link was described as the burden placed upon the plaintiff was to show that the principal reason for his discharge was the employer's, I believe in that case, had to do with retirement benefits.
Does this instruction differ in any significant way from that which was approved in Texas Department of Human Services against Green?
Does it differ? Yes, sir. The instruction that was requested here was lifted verbatim from your concurring opinion in the Winters versus Houston Chronicle case. That's my answer. We did not ask the same question, although I think the legal notions and the paradigms are pretty similar to, if not virtually identical to, the Mount Healthy kind of test. There have been numerous statutorily created exceptions to the employment at will doctrine, one of them being the Texas whistleblower statute. All of the exceptions noted by statute are based upon public policy considerations. Obviously, public policy a statutory enactment of an exception to the employment at will doctrine is the strongest statement of public policy. The historical public policy considerations, however, protecting with regard to protection of whistleblowers was thoroughly discussed in the concurring opinion of Justice Doggett in the Winters versus Houston Chronicle case, and that formed the basis for the requested instructions in this case.
You don't claim any language in the statute per se that requires the instruction which you tendered and which was rejected?
I don't believe that the statute addresses what the standard for the causal link should be. I believe that the statute is cited in that regard.
So where is it supposed to come from?
I think it's supposed to come from the courts to reasonably interpret what is meant to give the statute effect.
So it's up to us to decide whether it's a principal cause or a cause or...
I believe that it is, Your Honor. Of course, the public policy considerations in favor of the protection of whistleblowers are now well established or not at issue in this appeal. Employers have had serious concerns over the years regarding protection of whistleblowers. They have believed that excessive protection of whistleblowers will interfere with the legitimate operations of employers. They have worried that dishonest or irresponsible whistleblowers may act for spiteful or petty reasons or act in bad faith, and that a poorly performing employee may attempt to insulate himself from disciplinary actions or other legitimate personnel actions by blowing the whistle without the true motivations to protect the public good. The role of the judiciary then in balancing the interest between the employer and the employee should really be to craft a narrow exception to the employment at will doctrine that protects the interest of the responsible, law-abiding employer while holding accountable those whose conduct threatens the public interest.
Which was, of course, the whole purpose of the writing of the concurrence in Winters. How is
exactly.
it sufficient?
I'm sorry?
And how is the approach outlined in the concurrence in Winters deficient in accomplishing that objective?
In this case, Your Honor?
Well, as applied in this case.
As applied to this case, it's deficient because the court refused what is the final step, it seems to me. It refused the instruction to the jury, instructing them that Mr. Hines' whistleblowing conduct must have been the principal reason for the agency's action against him. Absent that, the jury was able to find that it could have contributed as only a reason, and we don't know what part of the reason was for Mr. Hines.
It's okay if it was a reason to fire him, in your opinion.
Well, I think this, like many other cases, are kind of mixed motive cases, and such as was identified by the United States Supreme Court in the Mount Healthy School District versus Boyle case, when there may be more than one motive which results in an employee being discharged.
It's under the employment at will doctrine, they could fire him because they don't like his smile.
That's true.
So as long as they can come up with any conceivable reason at all and combine that with an illegal reason, you say that they can fire him?
I say that the protected conduct must be the principal reason for his discharge, or the statute then would permit a person who engages in this conduct to be in a better position than he would have been had he done nothing. For example, if an employee is an employee with personnel problems and is going down the road and could be fired and should be fired, and then, quote, blows the whistle, and the issue is submitted to the jury in such a case, What did he engage in protected conduct, and was that any reason for his discharge? That response could be yes, and that employee could establish liability and recover damages, when in fact the real and more compelling reason might have been the employee's other personnel-related problems. That is what Justice Rehnquist referred to in the Mount Healthy case in the First Amendment context as putting the employee in a better position than had he done nothing.
I think under employment at will, must there always be a principal reason?
I don't think so. I think this court has...
Then a reason, then it's all that's necessary.
Well, I think the reason needs to be defined based upon the public policy considerations of a particular kind of case. Again, in Sabine Pilot, this court intended to carve out a very, very narrow exception to employment at will and required the plaintiff to show that his refusal to follow to engage in an illegal activity had to be the sole reason for his discharge. And for no other reason.
Whistleblower statute carves out a very narrow reason too, doesn't it?
Well, in Justice Doggett's concurring opinion in Winters, he used the language narrow exception. However, this was in relationship to a principal reason, which of course is somewhat less stringent than the sole reason. Causative link factor.
We keep coming back. Are we going to start having an issue that such and such is the principal reason? If under employment at will, I'll get back to my first question. Are we going to have a principal reason each time?
I don't know that we'd have to have a principal reason each time as we make exceptions, but the fundamental nature of employment at will is such that this court has historically been very careful to carve out exceptions. And once that exception is called out, it would seem to me that the court would want to make certain that whatever that exception was the reason for the employer's wrongful conduct. So I would expect to see lots of causal links that were defined as, at a minimum, the principal reason, but sometimes, as in Sabine's pilot, the sole reason.
If we accept your view of the law on this issue, must we necessarily disapprove Green?
I believe the findings would be inconsistent, although not the same issue was propounded in Green. The issue in Green arose as a result of the Assistant Attorney General there submitting an issue under Mount Healthy, and I've said before that I think that if you overlay the two legal paradigms, that they're virtually identical. In Mount Healthy, a plaintiff must show that his protected conduct, which is free speech in that context, was a substantial or motivating factor, and then the employer must show that they would have reached the same decision anyway, despite the protected conduct. This so-called but-for test would then eliminate what Justice Rehnquist described as placing the employee in a better position than had he done nothing. I believe that in the age of broad form submission and instructions which are clear and concise, the whole notion of principal reason encompasses all of that thought process and is a clear.
In your remaining time, would you take the opportunity to address the issue of mental anguish damages and whether there was any evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that that in this case, there was our primary reason for feeling that the mental anguish piece of this case should be reversed is because of the very, very little evidence, which we consider to be no evidence, before the court. Mr. Hines testified only that he felt humiliation or victimization or something.
You have no quarrel with the instruction on the law and the charge?
No, I have no quarrel with instruction on the law. My quarrel is that Mr. Hines' testimony does not reflect the relatively high degree of mental pain and suffering that was articulated and instructed to the jury in this particular case. We just don't believe, we believe that threshold is so low as to not be a threshold at all in this type of case, in which emotional damages or mental anguish damages are not the primary damages. They are only the damages which are collateral or incidental to the primary damages, which in this case was lost wages or lost future wages.
But isn't that the case in every mental anguish case? You know, he could have probably said, if he'd been coached perhaps, he lost sleep, trouble sleeping, trouble eating, failure to concentrate as a result of a trauma, you know.
I suppose, Justice Gonzalez, that he could have said that. The fact is that he did not. The only testimony before the court was that he felt humiliation, and he felt as if he was going to have to explain what happened to him to all of his friends, and it made him feel bad. I just don't think that rises to the level of the relatively high degree. As Justice Kohler observed in his dissent, that he didn't express anything that was any different from what anyone who might lose their job under any sets of circumstances. How do we tell the difference? And that, in my mind, is what makes it just no evidence of mental anguish.
What if the witness broke down crying as he gave that testimony and demonstrated his great emotional reaction to the jury? Would that make any difference?
I think that's more evidence of anguish.
Requiring magic words or a formula, aren't we just, as Justice Gonzalez alluded to, requiring witnesses to meet certain formulaic language requirements and just encouraging witnesses to perhaps elaborate on what actually happened?
Well, that's all about introducing evidence, it seems to me. It seems to me that had Mr. Hines experienced some of the things which may very well have could be reasonably characterized as mental anguish, he certainly would have talked about it. But all he was able to articulate in this case was, I felt humiliated and somehow victimized.
What about the witness who's unable to articulate as well as the next witness how they've experienced mental anguish?
I suppose that what I would do in a situation like that is I would bring in other witnesses who could describe what it was that the individual was going through. I'd bring in the wife, I'd bring in neighbors, I'd bring in some testimony to demonstrate this relatively high degree of mental pain and suffering. But my point is that did not occur in this case.
Mr. Horn, going back to your principal reason argument, why is not the nature of the good faith complaint not where you would otherwise argue that this was a disgruntled employee who had poor work performance and was fixing to get fired, and merely blew the whistle to throw a wrench into our firing? And why wouldn't that be the appropriate place for raising this issue about trying to improve their position as opposed to some other worker under the same or similar circumstances?
Well, I think in a defensive case you would raise it both places. Good faith applies to the report and whether or not the conduct in effect actually took place. Good faith may have an application as to whether or not a plaintiff actually believed that what he was reporting was a violation of law. And finally, that's a separate issue from the issue of the causal link between what the employee's conduct was and what motivated the employer to take their conduct. I see my time is up.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please support Mr. Cobb with that argument?
May it please the court, my name is Chip Cobb. I represent Gary Hines, the respondent and cross-petitioner in this case. First, this is not a common law incursion upon the employment at will situation. This is a legislatively enacted prohibition from terminating people for blowing the whistle with very stringent requirements. First, the cause of action must be brought within 90 days of the discrimination or it's barred. The burden of proof is on the employer under the statute to prove that the termination was for the reason that he blew the whistle. Statutory language has been defined in similar statutes, 8307C. The workers' compensation prohibition, you cannot fire somebody for the reason that they filed a workers' compensation claim. One of the first cases decided in the state courts with that regard was the Santex case, which we have cited in our brief. Interestingly, in the Santex case, the jury found that he was terminated for the reason of filing a workers' compensation claim, and also found that he was terminated because he failed to perform his job in a satisfactory manner. They had two findings. And the court said, we overruled the contention that this is an irreconcilable conflict, because we have held that if the employee is discharged because he filed a workers' compensation claim, he's protected, even though that is not the only cause. Santex was decided in 1981 before the legislature utilized the same language in enacting the whistleblower statute. The Fifth Circuit has had an opportunity to review a similar alleged conflict in issues. Mixed motive. Knowlton versus Greenwood Independent School District, 957 Fed 2nd, 1179. In that case, they found there was retaliation, that the employees were fired for reporting a violation of the law, and then the next issue that they were terminated for other reasons as well. And the Fifth Circuit said that latter finding is insignificant because the employees are protected. And that was interpreting the Whistleblower Act.
Do you agree with the opposing counsel that the causation proof and finding required is not established by the statute?
No, I do not. I believe that the section that creates the rebuttable presumption, section 3B, speaks to the level of causation required. That is, if you are terminated within 90 days of your report, you have a rebuttable presumption that you were suspended or terminated for reporting a violation of law. And that's the causal connection. Not solely because of, but for, one of the reasons. Similar language as in 8307C. Interestingly, this case was not submitted in a strict liability type context. That is, did Hines make a report? And was he terminated after that? That would be strict liability. Report protected forever. That wasn't the submission. The submission wasn't like the Knuper case where they said, was it the reason or a reason? And the court said that was sufficient. In this case, it was even more specific, a higher burden. Was he constructively terminated or otherwise discriminated against in retaliation for? Specific action in retaliation for. Specific causal connection. That issue with that specific causal connection went to the jury and the court's charge without objection as to the language in the issue. The only objection was that there was not an additional instruction that it not only be the principal reason, but the second sentence of that instruction reads, the principal reason is defined as the reason for termination. A common sense of reading of that as a layperson in a jury would be that the judge is requiring it to be the sole cause. This court, in the Winters case, refused to adopt protection for whistleblowers who are not protected legislatively, despite Justice Doggett's argument that if we're going to do it on our own accord without legislation, we should do so in the most limited possible manner. For retirement benefits, if we're going to create the exception, we're going to make it the principal reason. If it's for refusing to do an illegal act, it has to be the sole cause, because common law incursions into employment at will are going to be limited for strict public policy. This is not a public policy question for this court to address. The legislature did when they enacted the statute and said you cannot be terminated for reporting a violation. And it does not apply to every employee in the state of Texas. It does not require every employment decision to have a statement of reasons. It applies to public employees as defined in the statute.
What is the answer to the argument that an employee who is about to get fired anyway will make arguments that something illegal is being done to put himself in a better position?
Issue number one for the jury asked whether or not the report was made in good faith. And as defined, as requested by the Attorney General, good faith means honesty in fact in the conduct concerned. You're to consider Gary Hines' actual belief, as long as that belief was not unreasonable, and that Mr. Hines undertook to report the activities in good faith and not primarily as a result of some less admirable motive such as malice, spite, jealousy, or personal gain. And if they don't answer that question, yes, they never get to in retaliation for.
And you agree that the statute requires that?
Judge, I did not object to that part of the charge.
That's not what I asked.
And I did not brief whether good faith requires that instruction coming here to argue today.
If it doesn't require it, we're still back to the same argument, and what's the answer to it?
You have to look at a charge as a whole. In this case, good faith was submitted, and
what
he did have it.
Your
Honor, I still believe that the principal reason would be an inappropriate statement of law. Mount Healthy was talking about a United States Supreme Court sending something back to a federal judge where he found two motives. Since Mount Healthy has been decided, the Supreme Court has spoken on what it means in mixed motive cases in Price Waterhouse. And interestingly, in that case, Justice White, concurring in the judgment where it was a mixed motive case, sending it back, said, as in Mount Healthy, the district court found that the employer was motivated by both legitimate and illegitimate factors. As here is in Mount Healthy, and as the court now holds, Hopkins, the plaintiff, was not required to prove that the illegitimate factor was the only principal or true reason. In a mixed motive case, that's not the standard. If indeed there is a but-for argument, we would have done it anyway, then the appropriate type of instruction to request would be to go into the federal charges and have that argument in there, that if indeed they would have fired him anyway, regardless of the whistleblowing, then it's not in retaliation for. But there, the court would be defining a term in the charge and not commenting on the weight of the evidence. In retaliation for was the causal link in this case, and it was not requested to be defined.
So you say an instruction in this case would be okay if it said that if the employer would have fired him anyway, then it's not in violation of the statute?
If the employer has proved by preponderance of the evidence that he would have been terminated without regard to whistleblower activities.
So what's the difference between that instruction and a principal reason?
Well, because the principal reason says the cause has to be the sole cause, and that's not a mixed motive type case, and that's not what the legislature set up.
Well, if it didn't say the sole cause,
and
I'm having trouble distinguishing between the instruction you say ought to go in there, which is that the employer cannot be said to have violated the statute if he would have fired the employee anyway.
I'm saying that would be a more proper request for submission by the defendant because it would define a term in the charge. I'm not conceding that that would be the appropriate instruction or not, but in this case where you're saying the cause has to be this act, is to a common layperson, it means the sole cause.
Well, I'm
not
to argue that that should go in the charge. If you it's not just something you request.
If I said that, Mr. Justice Sector, I apologize. What this is a mixed motive case, if it's a mixed motive case at all, and I don't believe it is on the record as a whole.
Well, in another case, if you requested an instruction that we would have, if you find from a preponderance of the evidence that the employer would have fired him anyway, then it wasn't in violation of the statute. Should the court, is it error to refuse that instruction or not?
I believe it would not be error to refuse it.
So,
and if I was trying to spin off in an oral argument requested issues or instructions or otherwise in this limited situation, I apologize. I mean, those are things that you work through in writing, going back through the cases and reading.
So nothing like this belongs in the charge. So it could be that the jury could find from the evidence that even though the employer would have fired him anyway, they still find he violated the act.
If the issue is submitted, did they do it in retaliation for? Did a product defect, if any, cause harm? The argument is up to counsel to make and convince the jury that if they would have done it anyway, it wasn't in retaliation for.
And the court, in the charge?
Well, the court has said in a court and other cases that instructions that may be proper as to the law don't belong in the charge if they tend to push the jury one way or the other. And that if it's not defining a statutory term, and if the term is, the case is submitted in accordance with the statutory language, you don't want the charge full of somebody pushing one way and somebody pushing the other way.
Well, let me try this another way.
Yes, sir.
Do you think it is the law under the statute that if the employer would have fired him anyway, he didn't violate the statute?
I think under the statute as interpreted up to now, no, that is not the law. Nor should it be the law.
All right.
Because the statute...
So it doesn't make any difference if you request it or argue it or however you come about it. If the lawyer argues it, then it is objectionable. The other side ought to object to it because it's in violation.
There's still a causal link in retaliation for Justice Hatton. And if indeed the lawyer says he was going anyway and he filed this thing at late minute, not in good faith, to keep from doing it, himself, that's what the jury is for. In this case, Mr. Justice Heck,
but you said that instruction shouldn't go in there either.
No, I didn't say the good faith should not go. You asked me if indeed they hadn't requested it. And I said, I wasn't in that case. In this case, it was there. I did not object to it. It was part and parcel of their argument.
But you don't think it ought to be the law that that instruction is required?
I don't know that any instruction is required in all cases, no matter what. Sole cause is not always required in an automobile case, but it's proper in the appropriate circumstances. Intervening cause is not always required in every charge, but it's appropriate in the proper circumstances.
So do you say there are some cases in which the good faith charge is appropriate, even if it were objected to?
If indeed the evidence raised that there were other motives and that it was not a good faith, I would perceive such cases existing. In this case, Gary Hines had worked for 11 years without incident for the Texas Department of Human Services before his report was made. After his report, he got his first write-up. The atmosphere in his office changed. He got additional assignments. And speaking of the mental anguish, what he was put through was testified to by three of his coworkers. He was a disfavored employee. They looked for reasons to pick on him. Mr. Hines, in addition to talking about what his mental anguish was, talked on the stand in a moving way about the box that they had put in his supervisor's office with his name on it, so all his cases could go in there, so everybody knew he was under scrutiny. This mental anguish award of $18,000 for past mental anguish is sustainable by some evidence in the entirety of the record, including Mr. Hines' rather ineloquent efforts to express what he felt and why he felt it. Others saw it as well.
Did they testify?
Yes.
And what is the other evidence?
The other evidence is the extent to which he was subjected to additional scrutiny, the extent to which they, attempted to write him up for things that were not inappropriate. This is Ida Ornelas. This is Mr. I apologize. Blanca Madrid, Bobby Pettis, Blanca Madrid. They testified at pages 191, 213, and 259 of the statements of fact concerning what he was put through, that he was a disfavored employee, he was focused on. Mr. Hines testified in very moving terms of page 91 of the statement of facts regarding the putting out of the box and how it made him feel like he had a dunce cap on him in front of his employees. In addition, the submission of the issue follows cases that have been coming through the Court of Appeals and have either been written, not reviewed, or have been in the books prior to the time that the legislature has had opportunities to amend this statute.
Mr. Cobb, I want to be sure I understand. Earlier I asked you whether the causation requirement was set out in the statute, and I'm looking at the codification of the government code. I think what you referred me to was the section 554.004, burden of proof and presumption.
I'm looking at the 6252-16A, which was the act as it was at that time, section 3B, where it reads a public employee who sues under this section has the burden of proof, but it is a rebuttable presumption that the employee was suspended or terminated for reporting a violation of law.
I think this is a supposedly non-substantive codification of that, but my question is, you refer to the presumption that obtains if an employee is terminated within 90 days. This case was not submitted on that theory, was it?
No, it was not submitted because it wasn't terminated within 90 days of the act. It was submitted in the stricter sense in retaliation for.
And so I guess what I'm saying is I didn't understand your answer. Can you clarify for me how that section of the statute mandates the causation requirement?
This is the only causation requirement that's discussed in the act, and it says that if it's within 90 days, it's presumed to be four.
But you agree that doesn't pertain to this case?
No, I think it is. It's a guide to what the legislature intended with regard to the causation requirement. It didn't say solely for or any other reason, but for.
Well, even if it does apply, as with other evidentiary presumptions, if there is conflicting testimony, the presumption dissipates, and then we're back to square one.
The jury
was
not.
Explain how this provision of the statute controls the causation requirement.
The jury was not instructed as to any presumption, that there was a presumption that he had acted, that he had been fired for that reason or not. The causal nexus between the whistleblowing and the termination in the statute is found here, and it says for the whistleblowing, for reporting a violation of law. And that's because. That's the same language used in 8307C. The other courts that have submitted these issues, in City of Brownsville versus Pena, which is cited, the special issue was, did they discriminate against Pena in retaliation for reporting the violation? All of the cases that have submitted have found this submission to be proper. There hadn't been an instruction such as this requested and approved, and indeed the instruction in Green is similar and was rejected. Last, if I might, the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, after finding that there was sufficient evidence, both legally and factually, to uphold all the jury awards, took to carve out the future awards and to reduce them to present value using 15% compounded rate annually, citing cases which are liquidated damage cases, contract over terms, and citing other things which are inapplicable in an unliquidated damage type case. The law in the state of Texas has always been that where the jury issue asks if paid now in cash, that is sufficient to guide the jury to the point of present value. The case is cited in the brief of the Texas Department of Human Services. Do not apply. The Kansas City case that they cite was an FELA requirement. That is, the United States Supreme Court said that where state courts try FELA cases, they've got to give the instruction for reducing it to present value. The Texas courts, absent FELA cases, have consistently refused to require that type of instruction. In the Atchison Topeka versus Shepherd case, found at 447-216, it just said that that's not the law for other causes of action in the state of Texas. It's only in the FELA context. The other two cases, one of them, the Wanda Petroleum case, addressed whether or not a jury verdict in which the jury intended to write $1,300 per year during minority could be brought forward when all they had really answered in response to each minor child's damage issue was $1,300. The court said, we're not going to go forward and compute that to present value, and what the appropriate response is, where it's not an unambiguous jury finding, is new trial. Allen versus Rydell, that was reversed on grounds that the decedent's character had not been put into evidence, and that that was an appropriate element of evidence in a wrongful death case. The language that they wrote with regard to the present value said basically the jury had it, the jury listened to the evidence, and we're not going to reverse it on that basis. There's no basis in law or in the statutes that permits the carving out of future damages and reducing them at 15% per annum rate, nor for carving out future damages and reducing them absent presenting your own evidence regarding the present value and arguing it to the jury.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I think the first response I want to make is to the characterization of the requested instruction. It does request that the plaintiff be required to show that his whistleblowing conduct was the principal reason. And I think the instruction taken as a whole is substantially correct. I would admit that had we put the word primary in front of cause, it would have been a better instruction. There was never any attempt on the part of the department, nor do we argue here today, that we think the plaintiff's burden should be to prove that the sole reason or the only cause was his whistleblowing conduct. We think that this was a mixed motive case. We think that there was a significant amount of evidence before the jury that Mr. Hines had employment problems. The jury heard evidence that Mr. Hines' employment, that his performance, rather, had deteriorated to the fact in terms of how he kept records and updated his files, that he was dangerously close to getting an unsatisfactory performance evaluation. And this evaluation is based upon a very, very purely objective determination of looking at his casework. That would have led ultimately to his dismissal or suspension. This was imminent. It was coming up within the next month or two. There was a long history at the time of Mr. Hines' resignation. There was a long history of Mr. Hines having problems with other employees within the unit, of having a shouting match with his supervisor. This then could very well have represented in the minds of the jury, had they been properly instructed, that there was more than one reason why Mr. Hines resigned.
Mr. Horn, how do you respond to the concern that it's sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back? I guess Mount Healthy anticipates sort of this, but for doing this, they would not have been fired, which is really not a primary reason. Sort of like the straw that breaks the camel's back. You've elaborated on all the reasons why the department had the information necessary to fire, but they didn't.
now there's a whistleblower, and now they just throw up their hands and said, we've worked with this fellow long enough, it's time for him to move on, so they fire him. And they have all these reasons, none of them, any one of which is a valid reason for firing, and probably should have fired him. But he makes this retaliation claim, and that's the deal that flips the switch. So it's entirely possible the jury under primary, under the primary inspection, such as you say, could say that wasn't the primary reason he was fired. On the other hand, but for him doing retaliation, he wouldn't have been fired. How do you respond under your instruction actually being more than what you'd otherwise ought to be entitled to?
If I understand your question correctly, it seems to me that there can be any number of reasons in a situation in which an employee could be dismissed. If one of those reasons involves an improper motivation of an employer who retaliates because the employee has engaged in protected conduct, and that motivation represents the principal reason why the employee is terminated, then liability should attach to that behavior of the employer. If, on the other hand, there is less substance to the motivation of the employer for the employee's protected conduct, but greater and perhaps more compelling reasons for his dismissal for legitimate reasons, then the fact that he engaged in protected conduct should not create liability if the employer should have had the right to fire the individual in the first place. I think those are the two legal notions or legal paradigms that are described in the Mount Healthy analysis, as well as kind of folded in all together and overlaid in the notions in the principal reason analysis, especially as that they were presented in Judge Doggett's concurring opinion. One of the statements that was made in that opinion was that the proper standard should be applied in this and all whistleblower cases. Failure to establish the causal connection between the whistleblower and the subsequent discharge is fatal to the employee's suit.
You agree if it was error to submit question number two without this instruction, you were required in order to preserve that error to submit it in substantially correct form?
I agree. That's what the law is.
And the instruction says you are instructed that the, quote, principal reason, close quote, means that the reporting of a violation of law was the cause of the harassment or discrimination. You can see that it would have been better to put primary or some other qualifying word before cause, but how is this instruction in substantially correct form when it tells the jury that the principal reason the cause?
I believe in reading those two sentences as a whole, the jury would have reached the conclusion that what they have to do is determine that it was the principal cause. I believe it is substantially correct as the question.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.